From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. We've been sitting in these chairs about 6 months now, and we can't help but think about how we've been doing. In a few minutes, partly just to show off and partly because we need a break, we're going to bring you a couple of the pieces and interviews we've already run, pieces that we believe offer a pretty good illustration of what we had in mind when we reinvented On the Media.
But first, we thought we'd hear from you. David Heinz wrote, "I've only recently discovered your show. I find the rare breath of truth about commercial media to be exhilarating. Without shows like yours, the corporate coup d'etat would be complete and completely invisible. I'll continue to be a habitual listener."
And this general comment from Frank Haber, "I make it a point to listen to your show as often as possible. The show is well produced, always topical, and mostly on target. You dig the dirt while somehow staying on the reportorial side of that magic line." Well, that's nice. But then he continues, "When you get too internecine or run out of things newsworthy, you acquire certain National Enquirer traits."
We can't conclude this segment of listener criticism without hearing from Ronald D. Giles of Glenmore, Pennsylvania, who writes, "Here are the words I would apply to this program. Downer.
Negative.
Petulant.
Snickering.
Spoiled.
Wronged.
Mournful.
Dark.
And pissy. Even the musical stings are in the minor key," he writes. "The pacing is dreadful, the announcers have frowns in their voices, and I'm sure the staff wears black."
Well, in fact, many of us do wear black, but mainly because it's, you know, slenderizing. We want to hear your comments, story pitches, or lists of adjectives. We want to hear your general suggestions, your specific complaints, and what pleases you, too. Write to us at onthemedia.org, and be sure to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. There are some stories that journalists can't seem to report without bringing down an avalanche of criticism. Certainly, coverage of gun control and abortion inspires heated debate, but nothing, nothing like the rage that invariably follows stories about Israel. We have received letters asking us to look into American coverage of the Middle East, but for reasons that soon will be clear, that is a near impossibility. Instead, we invite you to examine the perspectives of the critics. What follows is a report from the ground that we regard as balanced and fair about the challenges faced by reporters in the disputed territories. Afterwards, we asked two critics for their reactions. First, a report on journalists caught in the middle from Rick Davis.
"And don't let me take it down, don't let me, and release."
Firm but gentle orders from a physical therapist at Jerusalem's Mount Scopus Hospital.
Stay.
Yola Monikoff lifts her leg, but not much. Her pelvis is shattered, nerve ending severed. On November 11th, this 26-year-old freelance photographer was in Bethlehem on her first assignment for the Associated Press. "It was a fairly quiet day," she says. "Young Palestinians were throwing a few rocks. The Israeli army responded with one tear gas round. Then an Israeli soldier came around the corner. The Palestinians ran. Yola ducked into a doorway.
I looked up, and there he was. He was about 50 meters away, and I saw that he was a soldier. I saw that he was wearing a helmet, and I saw that his gun was aimed at us."
And then the soldier fired.
"I was screaming like a girl, and I wanted to let the soldier know that, hey, buddy, you made a mistake."
A mistake the Israeli army now admits. Standing orders were violated. A soldier can only fire live ammunition when he is in immediate mortal danger.
According to the army, there are two people to blame, two people who broke the rules of engagement, as they put it. An officer who first gave the order to shoot, which meant to shoot with live fire.
And the young man who fired the shot.
The soldier who shot me received an order to go shoot the Palestinian wearing the gray T-shirt and jeans, and I think was, you know, very scared and did a very shoddy job and just came out, you know, followed orders that were illegal.
Yola Monikoff calls the West Bank and Gaza the mean streets.
Yeah, I mean, I have a friend, an Israeli photographer, who caught a Palestinian bullet in his lens. So, of course, it's dangerous. Everywhere, and you know, you never know where it's coming from.
Journalists are often caught in the middle on the many days when Israeli tank fire responds to Palestinian gunfire and the constant rain of rocks. The New York-based Committee to Protect Journalists has raised the question, are reporters being singled out as targets? Many believe they are. The Israeli army and the Palestinian Authority say no. But the committee has documented a long list of shootings, beatings, and harassment. Example, October 31st. CNN's Cairo bureau chief Ben Wiedemann was at the Gaza-Israeli border. It was a day of heavy fire. During a lull, Wiedemann was trying to take down a camera tripod. He was shot in the back. Mike Hanna is the Jerusalem bureau chief for CNN.
The bullet was found in the flak jacket when it was subjected to ballistics analysis back in the United States, and it was an Israeli bullet. The Israelis have apologized, if indeed they say they were responsible for the shooting. They insist that it was not intentional. I take their words on that particular element of trust, given the circumstances on that particular day.
There are other times there is little doubt that violent action is intentional. Example, Lee Hockstetter of the Washington Post. He wrote a story about the Israeli army's use of lethal force. It was at night. He was at home.
We heard a boom as we were preparing dinner. And unfortunately, these days, one hears booms in the evening in particular quite a bit. And so we thought nothing of it. As we sat down to dinner, noticed the fire engine, red lights flashing outside our living room window, went outside to see flames shooting up from our cars.
Now it seems more than ever in the Middle East, you will be on someone's bad guy list, maybe everyone's.
Feelings run so high that you simply cannot convince people that there is any such thing as an impartial, dispassionate observer. Everyone's convinced that if you're not with them, you're against them.
And that leads to attempts by both the Israelis and the Palestinians to control how a story is covered and at times prevent any coverage. Ramallah, a West Bank town, October 12th. Two Israeli soldiers were captured and taken to a Palestinian police station. A group of young Palestinians forced their way into the building. The police seemed to do little to stop them. The mangled body of one Israeli was thrown from the building. The other was lowered by rope. The killers leaned from a window, showing their bloody hands to a cheering crowd. There were many photographers there that day, most of them Palestinians. But the only images ever seen came from one Italian cameraman. Why only one? Nasser Atta, a Palestinian producer for ABC News, describes the day.
They stopped us physically by putting our cameras down. Some people, their cameras were taken from them. They were confiscated. And some were beaten to stop filming. The youth were so angry there, and they were out of control, actually, really out of control. I think we just said we will stop filming instead of us being beaten or stabbed or anything like this.
Mob rule is not the only thing Palestinian reporters face from their fellow Palestinians. Some have been arrested and jailed. Newspapers, radio, and television stations have been closed by the ruling Palestinian Authority. The dangers can be far greater for an Israeli journalist.
I do the coverage of the West Bank and Gaza since 67. I never remember such a time.
Danny Rubenstein is one of Israel's most acclaimed reporters, but he seldom goes to the West Bank or Gaza now, where no one believes any Israeli can be a neutral observer and anyone can be a spy.
And if you don't serve them, they look on you as their enemy. And also here, my people, if I write something that doesn't serve the interest of the Israeli government, they say, what are you doing? We are just state of war. So I would say really it's one of the most problematic period in my career as a journalist, no doubt about it.
And you've been at this a long time.
Yeah, since the war in 67, which means almost 34 years.
Many Israelis are convinced that the Western media are a tool in a propaganda war. And Major Yardin Vatakai, the foreign press officer for the Israeli army, says the Palestinians are winning that war.
I believe that since the very beginning, everything that they organized was with the vision to be covered and to be viewed by all the world. Their image of this conflict managing better than us, managing to control the press and the products of the press more than us.
But Paul Adams of the British Broadcasting Corporation says when it comes to propaganda, the Israelis win hands down.
The Palestinians remain hopeless at it. which comes as a surprise to Israelis who believe that there's a very slick Palestinian propaganda operation going on. There simply isn't.
And Adams says it's Israel and its supporters that are running a propaganda campaign with letters of protest and email messages. An example, his BBC crew was pushed around and punched a couple of times in a confrontation with Palestinians. Adams says it was too insignificant to report, but...
Before I knew it, the BBC in London was receiving dozens of email messages accusing the BBC of covering up a brutal assault on a BBC crew by Palestinian officials. It all came from an organization in the States, pro-Israel, right-wing organization that monitors media coverage of the Middle East. They had encouraged their supporters to send these messages, and in due course they all came sounding all rather similar.
Mike Hanna of CNN says you have to get used to it.
We have criticism from the Israeli government. We have criticism from the Palestinians. A lot of the time their job is propaganda. Our job is news. They are two sides that actually don't coexist very happily.
Push, push me, push, up, 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 and release.
Yola Monikoff is just one journalist who may have been caught in that unhappy coexistence. She faces months, perhaps years of therapy up. To repair a body shattered by a gunshot.
Stay, stay, stay.
So after all this, do you think you chose the right profession?
Yeah, I chose the right profession. I mean, you have to do what you have to do to record events that happen, I think. But of course, you know, I'll have more regrets if my foot doesn't start working than if it does.
For On the Media, I'm Rick Davis.
Well, Rick Davis is now back from Israel, and he is with us. Welcome, Rick.
Thank you.
So what do you hear from Yola? Is her foot going to heal?
She will be in the United States for treatment soon. Her internal injuries and her pelvis seem to be healing well, but she has no reawakening of the nerves in her leg. So long-term, we don't know. The miracle of it all is that a spirit of cooperation managed to save her life. The young Palestinians who were throwing rocks put her on a stretcher. They picked up her camera gear. They took her to Beit Jala Hospital. And there the Palestinian doctor called a colleague, an Israeli doctor in Jerusalem.
Because he couldn't handle her injuries there?
Yeah, too complicated. And they arranged for an ambulance, the Israeli ambulance, a Palestinian ambulance, to rendezvous at a checkpoint and get her into better care in Jerusalem.
And that's why she's alive.
That's it.
Thanks very much, Rick.
Welcome.
Coming up, we'll hear from two critics on opposite sides of the Israeli-Palestinian divide. They'll tell us whether the report you just heard was balanced and fair. Also, a profile of cable's leading talking head, Bill O'Reilly.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. We've just heard Rick Davis's piece on the difficulty of reporting from the ground in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Now we'll get a sense of how it plays here. We invited two commentators to critique Rick's report.
Gary Rosenblatt is editor and publisher of Jewish Week. Welcome, Mr. Rosenblatt.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you. And also Rashid Khalidi, who is director of the Center of International Studies and a professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Chicago. Thank you very much for being here.
It's a pleasure.
What we're particularly interested in this interview is to hear how this piece that you just heard sounded to your different ears. Do you think this piece conveyed, if not a complete picture, at least a realistic picture of the issues that journalists face on the ground? Mr. Rosenblatt.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of levels here. Certainly on one level, there was a give and take, and there's a certain symmetry here. The problem, which is a deeper level, is a kind of media focus and sometimes obsession with symmetry. Palestinians lynch two Israelis, and later that day, Israel retaliates by firing rockets on a building after alerting the neighborhood, and so there are no casualties. So the next day it's reported Palestinians did X and Israel retaliates with Y. But I think what's missing is a kind of moral relativism. These are not equal incidents of violence, and sometimes they're reported that way.
Strangely enough, I find myself in agreement. I think that what is missing, especially from American media coverage, I thought it was a good piece, but what's missing from American media coverage is a historical and analytical framework. I mean, Israelis are being killed in occupied territory. That has to be driven home or you're not telling the truth. The day-to-day brutality, violence of the occupation is never set against whatever violence, quote-unquote, stone-throwing kids or snipers are using against occupation soldiers and settlers who are there in violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention. Just to use terms like the Fourth Geneva Convention means we're talking about a level of analysis which this piece and most, frankly, most journalism doesn't address. I'm not just talking about moral relativism. I'm talking about context and background, the kind of thing that you get in much of the coverage in, say, the Israeli press or the European press or the Arab press, unfortunately, tends to be missing.
Well, I'll agree with the professor in terms of the need for analytical and contextual, you know, focus on these issues. When people start talking about Geneva Conventions and Resolution 242 and 338 and the Balfour Declaration, you can sense people's eyes glazing over. And that's part of the general problem I think we have with people wanting very short news bites and just wanting headlines rather than context.
I'd like to bring in the reporter now, Rick Davis, who has been listening to this discussion. Welcome again.
Thank you.
Now, you've heard from both Mr. Rosenblatt and from Mr. Khalidi that there were critical things missing from your report. How would you address that?
I would say they're both right when it comes from the lack of historical and analytical coverage in the story and in the Middle East itself, particularly in the American news media. And I have covered the Middle East for a long time, and I think we have always been in error in doing that.
Why don't you address the practical considerations of covering the Middle East, then? Obviously, most news holes don't allow for a story even a third as big as the one you just produced for us. So how can one cover it if one has to go over the historical ground every single time?
That's always been the problem in the Middle East, just as it was the problem in Bosnia. Every time you had to go through it, you seemed to have to start at phase one. But the problem is that everybody has a different view of phase one. What is the history of the Middle East? What are the causes of what's going on there? You're never going to find a way of answering that question.
And so then the question is it possible for any reporter to cover the Middle East to the satisfaction of Mr. Rosenblatt and Mr. Khalidi and Mr. Davis? Mr. Khalidi?
I wouldn't give advice to a veteran like Rick. What I would say is, you know, pay attention to two big problems that are structural. One is the nature of the medium, how hard it is to get a long, detailed piece across. And the second thing is to deal with the prejudices back home of the editors, producers, and people who don't know anything about anything. They have strong feelings, but they've never been there and they don't know anything. They have sympathies, though, most of them for Israel. And there's no countervailing force. I mean, we don't have the Arab American community and the Muslim American community haven't developed to the point where they've thrown up the dozens and dozens of people who've done journalism and have reached that stage. In 30 or 40 years, you wouldn't be able to make this complaint. 50 years ago, you wouldn't have had anybody who was Jewish in those positions.
Well, curiously, our readers would say that, you know, everything the professor said was true, except that the bias that's coming from the editors is not a pro-Israel bias, but rather a pro-Palestinian bias.
Rick, do you have one more comment?
No, except my agreement that they're both right. It's one of the few times I've must been criticized for covering two sides of the story.
You chose a hard row to hoe, what can I say?
I want to thank you both for being here. Gary Rosenblatt, editor and publisher of The Jewish Week, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Rashid Khalidi, who is the director of the Center of International Studies and a professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Chicago, thank you too.
You're welcome.
Fox News Channel's The O'Reilly Factor is often rated the number one cable news program in prime time, running neck and neck with Larry King. O'Reilly's book, also called The O'Reilly Factor, was a New York Times bestseller. We wondered, who is this man who vanquished Larry King in the ratings and the Beatles book in the stacks? Our producer-at-large Mike Pesca reports, you decide.
5 seconds.
I'll probably hold on. It's going to get loud here.
Music, come up. Cute.
The O'Reilly Factor is on tonight. The tension mounts as the Florida Supreme Court takes its time in deciding...
In the basement of the Midtown Manhattan headquarters of the Fox News Channel, the reigning king of cable news, Bill O'Reilly, has just set the table for another episode of The O'Reilly Factor.
Caution, you are about to enter a no-spin zone.
O'Reilly says he'll smack the spin right out of you, unless it's spin O'Reilly agrees with. But then, that's not spin. O'Reilly's viewers, the folks, he calls them, won't countenance spin either. But they love O'Reilly. Or maybe they love to disagree with O'Reilly. Either way, and this is all that matters to Fox, they watch O'Reilly. On a good night, 1 million households tune in. 1 million households isn't enough to keep network programming on the air. It's not close to the ratings of a Rush Limbaugh, and if 1 million households watch a Hollywood movie, it's dubbed a flop. But in the world of cable news, it's blockbuster, and O'Reilly is a star.
He doesn't just accept the spin from his guests, and I don't think he seems like he's controlled. He is oddly attractive. He's very, very masculine.
Ann Klenk is a veteran television producer who created the MSNBC program Equal Time and turned Mary Matlin into a TV personality. She advises talk show talent, but when it comes to O'Reilly, she wouldn't change a thing. She says the entire format needs exactly the kind of jolt that O'Reilly provides.
Shouldn't Hillary Clinton then, when it was proven that she was used by her husband, shut up, not continue to support the man?
While the bulk of cable news is comfortable being AM radio on TV, O'Reilly and his rival Larry King host two of the only programs where the dominant image is of two people talking. No panel of pundits, no two-headed anchors, one from the right, one from the left. One host, one guest, having it out.
And you're a supporter of Hillary Clinton, I understand, correct?
Yes.
Here, O'Reilly's brought on Linda Waite, author of a book on marriage. On the pages of the New York Times, Waite opined that it was unfair to pummel Hillary Clinton for not getting a divorce. O'Reilly quickly dismisses that narrow argument and has the University of Chicago professor answer for all the wrongs of Hillary's tenure as First Lady.
How can you support someone who the Justice Department says is a perjurer?
Well, I have to tell you, Bill, you're getting outside my area of expertise.
But you're an American citizen. Why would you, as a college professor, vote for somebody who lied under oath?
Well, I think because, in my view, she's extremely bright, very well trained, extremely, I think, politically savvy.
And so was Mao Zedong.
It's a favorite tactic of O'Reilly's, barbecuing sacred cows through surrogates, be they official spokesmen or flimsy frontmen. Where did O'Reilly learn such tricks?
People have to be persuaded to even listen nowadays. Now, I'm not trying to convert them a la Rush Limbaugh, but I just want them to see my point. And I learned that at Harvard.
O'Reilly's probably the only person in news with entries on his resume from both Harvard and Inside Edition. One gave him standing as a serious thinker. The other taught him to connect to an audience. His audience.
The O'Reilly Factor TV show and the O'Reilly Factor book is basically the first national presentation on television, and I think in nonfiction literature, that was written expressly for working Americans. That's who I represent.
When you add the part in your book about how when you double-dated with Donald Trump, how do you think your audience is going to react to that, is you as this champion of the working class?
If a working class guy like me makes it, they're happy for me. And I think I have an obligation to help them as well with the knowledge that I've accumulated.
But not everyone's gracious enough to accept O'Reilly's help.
The fact that he's so popular and that his insipid book is the number one bestseller, to me, is a very symptomatic of what's happened to talk radio and talk television, that the worse you are, the baser you are, the more popular your ratings seem to be.
Harvard professor Alan Dershowitz is a ubiquitous cable presence, but he draws the line at O'Reilly. In fact, he boycotts all of Fox programming, both local and national, because of O'Reilly. Dershowitz says that it has nothing to do with O'Reilly's conservatism. On that point, he won't get an argument. O'Reilly says he's not a conservative. His political hero is Bobby Kennedy. He supports gun control. He opposes the death penalty. Instead of executions, here's O'Reilly's solution.
Much better is to banish them to a life of hard labor. Look, a death by injection or gas or however you're going to do it, it's 2 minutes. There's a little suffering, mostly psychological, before you get there, and you're gone. Most of the time they sedate these people. I don't know if people know that, but they give them a sedative before they execute them. That's not the worst death in the world.
Well, it's considered humane to do it that way.
Whatever it is.
A recurrent theme of O'Reilly's talk show career has been positioning himself beyond political parties.
Everybody tries to label me, and I don't like it. I'm a registered independent politically, and I'm a journalist who looks at life the way it is, not the way I want it to be.
In reality, O'Reilly is not a registered independent. He's been a registered Republican since 1994. When this information came to light after our original interview, O'Reilly said he made a mistake when registering to vote in Nassau County, Long Island, 6 years ago. But records show that he's voted in at least 5 elections since then, each time being confronted with his party registration, which he never took any steps to change. O'Reilly now says that the mistake has been corrected and he finally is a registered independent. That also is not entirely true. Nassau County does not allow someone to re-register until one general election has passed, so he won't be a registered independent until November 2002. But why is O'Reilly so eager to be seen as an independent? Political talk show consultant Ann Klenk.
I watch these shows, The Left and the Right, so often. They are really put in a partisan straitjacket. Go into the green room. It's all gray area. I mean, these political talk shows are similar to professional wrestling, and these are fake fights.
Fake is anathema to O'Reilly. He has somehow managed to balance honesty and self-promotion. Granted, he postures as a hero to the working man. His book is full of grooming advice, and he has 3 chapters on child rearing, even though he has less than 2 years' experience as a parent. He knows he's sometimes rude.
I just have no diplomatic skills.
He plays the huckster.
Appreciate you getting the book very much, and that goes for everybody else who has picked up the Factor tome.
And he's as ratings conscious as anyone on TV.
8 o'clock, CNN 1.2, Larry King Live 1.4.
Yes.
Hardball at 8. Hardball at 5 on MS at 1.3.
They run that 15 times a day, and then MSNBC at 8.
Despite the showmanship, this is not a role. Unlike almost any other political chat show, you can't recast the lead in the O'Reilly Factor. On this night, Bill O'Reilly has just thrown the program to commercial. Only the people in the control room and O'Reilly in the studio can see the next guest on the feed from Washington. Laura Ingraham is a smart, very attractive conservative commentator whose latest book is called The Hillary Trap. To O'Reilly, who brags about his success with the ladies in his own book, Ingraham's next words couldn't be more gratifying.
How does it feel to be the Elvis of talk?
Is that what I am now?
That's basically all the girls are saying down here.
I'm the Elvis of talk.
Yeah. Groans aside, O'Reilly's staff knows it's working for the king of cable news. This show ends, but Elvis can't leave the building. He's taping again in 2 hours. Just enough time to order dinner. Part showman, part wonk, graduate of Harvard and Inside Edition, O'Reilly calls out, "Turkey burger, 2 slices of American cheese." For On the Media, I'm Mike Pesca.
Thank you, Mike, for that informative piece.
You're welcome, Barbara. Brooke.
But the story of you and O'Reilly didn't end there, did it?
No, it did, actually. All right, fine, it didn't. Now that you mention it, after the piece aired, it got picked up and written about in some places, and one was this media industry tip sheet called The Hotline. And O'Reilly had a quote in The Hotline saying, "I never heard of Mike Pesca. Mike Pesca never called me. The first time I heard about this piece was when I read about it in The Hotline."
But you called him.
Well, not only did I call him, I sat next to the guy for a couple hours in his office, and I interviewed him. That's what you heard on the tape. So we went back and forth a little bit. He actually wound up inviting me on his show a couple of times, canceling a couple of times, and now there's sort of an open-ended invitation that never got picked up on his end.
That's when you started writing those O'Reilly diaries for onthemedia.org.
Right. The O'Reilly diaries are 3 or 4 fully interactive diaries about my preparations for going on the show that he wound up backing out of. Bill. And they're still on the site. They haven't been updated in a while, but they're just hanging out there in limbo, which actually is a conscious effort on my part to instill in the reader the same kind of free-floating befuddlement that I myself experienced through the whole post-O'Reilly period.
Really?
No, no, not really. But now you know the rest of the story.
Thank you. On the Media's producer at large, Mike Pesca.
Not long ago, Loyola University in Chicago began to offer a service called the Ethics Advice Line. With a simple telephone call, a journalist struggling with an ethical dilemma can be helped in a hurry. Of course, the advice line faces a few obstacles. Foremost, what journalist is going to outsource a decision that could break a career? And even if one would, how would one know the service exists? Which is why we at On the Media decided to offer this humble contribution to the advancement of ethics in journalism, the On the Media Ethics Hotline.
I was confused. I needed direction.
The Ethics Hotline.
I didn't know who to source, I didn't know when to footnote, and I didn't know where to turn.
The Ethics Hotline.
Then I called the Ethics Hotline.
Don't trust those other so-called ethicists. The Ethics Hotline has ethics experts standing by 24 hours a day to help you with all your ethical needs.
Hello, Ethics Hotline. I've been a very naughty journalist. I have the urge to blow this story all out of proportion.
Sorry, we're not that kind of hotline.
Hello, Ethics Hotline. I picked up a murder plot on my baby monitor. Can I report it?
Ethics Hotline can help.
I have evidence that exonerates Puffy Combs, but I hate his music. What should I do?
Ethics Hotline can help.
Hello, Ethics Hotline. I plagiarized the Bible. Am I going to hell?
Yes.
Thanks, Ethics Hotline.
Thanks, Ethics Hotline.
Thanks, Ethics Hotline.
Thanks, Ethics Hotline.
Damn you, Hotline. I'm taking you down with me.
Ethics Hotline, $5 a first minute, 99 cents each additional minute. Some Boston Globe columnists may qualify for bulk discounts.
Coming up, the scream that deserves an Oscar and anthems that make you want to sell something.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In this part of the show, you'll find a couple of examples of how broadly we define the term media. Anything that grabs hold in the press or in popular culture grabs our attention, too. And that broad definition seems to work for listeners also, if the Wilhelm is anything to go by. This piece generated an avalanche of email just as our program was getting off the ground.
It's just a scream made by an anonymous actor who has no doubt passed on. His cry of anguish, however, will live probably forever. On the Media's David Sirchuk presents The Wilhelm.
The Wilhelm has punctuated the death and dismemberment of dozens of characters in some 20 to 25 movies, particularly in those associated with George Lucas. with appearances in some of history's biggest hits. From Star Wars to Raiders of the Lost Ark to Toy Story, clearly this sound gets around. In addition to the aforementioned blockbusters, the scream appeared in lesser Lucas films, like Howard the Duck and Willow, as well as the Star Wars parody Spaceballs. Prior to being adopted by the Lucas team in 1977, the Wilhelm got its shot in Sam Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch in 1967, and co-starred with Judy Garland in 1954's A Star Is Born. It even appeared in John Wayne's gritty drama The Green Berets in 1968.
That's what it's all about, Mr. Beckwith!
After The Green Berets, the Wilhelm went on sabbatical until it was revived in Star Wars. It appears in the scene where Luke and Leia bravely blasted stormtroopers from across a bottomless pit in the Death Star. Right before our heroes swing across, young Skywalker shoots a stormtrooper, who falls both into the depths and Hollywood history. The Wilhelm is also in Steven Spielberg's Raiders of the Lost Ark. In this film, the Wilhelm again marks the falling death of a bad guy. The Wilhelm comes into play this time while Indiana Jones fights off Nazis, while simultaneously driving a truck. All the commotion causes one poorly balanced Nazi to fall out. But the Wilhelm has graced smaller films as well. Prior to its use in these hits, it gave years of service to such B-movie classics as 1954's Them, where it punctuated James Whitmore's death in the mandibles of a giant ant. But the Wilhelm's work in Them was not finished, for it also became the death knell of an army private later in the film. The Wilhelm was popularized in name by Ben Burtt, the Oscar-winning sound editor for Star Wars, says Richard Anderson, sound editor and president of Weddington Productions in North Hollywood. Anderson worked with Burtt on both Star Wars and Raiders, placing the Wilhelm in the latter film. He said Burtt, an old-time Hollywood film buff, was inspired to track the sound to its roots, after noting how frequently it occurred in his favorite B-films.
The earliest film that he had noticed that it was in was a film called Charge at Feather River, which was made in 1953, I believe. There's a character in the movie named Wilhelm, and at one point in the movie, he's there riding along, and then the arrow flies in and hits him in the leg, at which point he does this now famous scream.
Wilhelm!
Yeah, I'll just fill my pipe!
Anderson adds that Burtt was eventually able to track the first use of the Wilhelm to an even earlier film.
While at Warner Brothers, he ultimately found the original source recording of it under the title Man Being Eaten by Alligator. It turns out that this film was a 1951 film called Distant Drums, directed by Raoul Walsh and starred Gary Cooper.
The Wilhelm also surfaced in the 1955 film In the Land of the Pharaohs, where it is again used by a character battling a large reptile, in this case, a crocodile, except this time it comes from inside the crocodile after the character is eaten. Rick Henson, president of the Motion Picture Sound Editors, showed a short compilation of films with the Wilhelm at the MPSE Golden Reel Awards last spring. Henson says part of the attraction of the Wilhelm is that it helps sound editors personalize their projects, even if no one notices it but them or other sound editors.
I think it's very much a sense of marking your film, of autographing the sound on it.
Steve Altobello, sound editor at Spin Cycle Post in New York, has used the Wilhelm in three films, including the Jay-Z documentary Backstage. He says part of the pleasure in using the Wilhelm is that it doesn't fit naturally into the small, independent films he mostly works on.
I don't want to say it's a stupid sound, but it's ridiculous. It's certainly extremist. You watch it once and you don't know it's there, you're like, okay, this scene's fine. But when you watch it knowing it's there, it really does leap out of the soundtrack too. You're like, oh my God, that's a huge, ridiculous scream there, but it works. They always find the right spot, the right frame.
Sound editors like Anderson and Altobello say that often when directors notice the Wilhelm, they demand it be pulled. But it seems it's become almost an obsession for Altobello, and frequently the first thing he looks for in a new project is the Wilhelm moment.
I've even tried to mix it in, like mix it into a track so that it can't be removed. Like, if you want this car sound on that TV set, you got to have the scream. I can't even turn, you know, and I act stupid, like, well, I don't know. That's just part of it, you know? I tried to get it into an HBO after-school special about not using drugs, but the filmmaker pulled it out. I tried to get it into a film called Chicago Cab, and they were like, you've got to be kidding me.
Altobello and Henson both admire how the Wilhelm infiltrated A Star Is Born. In fact, they each cited it as their favorite use of the sound. Altobello even went so far as to say he uses it as an homage to that movie rather than the Lucas films.
Whoever put it in the movie in the background for one scene, that's fine. That was probably expected. But whoever found a way to weasel it into the arrangement of a Judy Garland song, that's somebody who really pulled off the ultimate, I think, because the movie stops and it's the only thing that's happening. I'll never be able to pull that off.
Somewhere there's a someone, somewhere, someone, somewhere.
Ah! Rick Henson of the MPSE added that another creative application of the Wilhelm is in the 1995 Disney film A Goofy Movie. This use is especially interesting, he said, because Goofy himself has his own signature yodel that in the fashion of the Wilhelm has been used in many other Disney films. The Wilhelm appears this time as Goofy carelessly drives into the ladder of some characters working on a roadside.
And please don't forget me, I will return someday. Oh, I may be an attraction when I do.
In addition to being goofy, however, Altobello finds the continued use of the Wilhelm somewhat disturbing. He says it's intriguing and spooky that this sound continues to be used years after the original unknown actor has probably passed on.
It was one guy who really did this for whatever reason. It could have even been a sound editor. It could have been vocal talent that was hired. Did it 50 years ago, and it's still floating around. It's a really creepy concept. I always wondered about people who were relatives of, like, the woman whose voice is on At the Tone, The Time Will Be. I always thought, well, what if that's some guy's, like, ex-girlfriend or something, and he just calls and listens to The Time?
Whatever the fate of the original actor who voiced the Wilhelm, this scream of death has plenty of life left. In addition to its recent use in the trailer for Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, shooting is currently underway for Episode II. And if Episode II doesn't do so well, maybe George Lucas would consider a remake of Charge at Feather River. If he does, it's a safe bet they'll know which sound to start with. For On the Media, I'm David Sirchak.
Nowadays, when we think of corporate media, we think of newspapers and TV stations, movie studios, and publishing houses owned by large corporations. But there is another kind of corporate media, the kind designed only for corporations to consume, songs and roadshows designed to build company pride and devotion.
Corporate anthems aren't geared to customers, but to company staff. And though they may have just arrived in Britain, they have long been a staple of management in Japan, Korea, and elsewhere in the Far East. Of course, here in America, we have inevitably taken the form right over the top, as On the Media's Rex Stone reports.
Early corporate anthems like this one for IBM sounded more like fight songs for someone's dear old alma mater than anything else. But by the 1950s, mere song and verse gave way to big, brassy industrial shows with multiple musical numbers dedicated to pushing product.
Standing on the corner, watching all the Fords go by. Standing on the corner, giving all the Fords the eye.
Steve Young is a writer for The Late Show with David Letterman and is the foremost collector and researcher of industrial show souvenir albums.
They were very lavishly produced Broadway-style reviews, often using legitimate Broadway talent and name-brand composers to put on a whole musical to motivate the sales force and not only just inspire them to sell, but also inspire them to feel good about the way of life they've chosen.
Coca-Cola,
daily gaining in strength, drawn from the experience of the past and the opportunities of the here and now.
Some of the big corporations like GM and Coca-Cola have a lot of very bombastic material that goes beyond just details about the product that may be at hand, but giving you a much more overarching view of this. This is more than just a product that we're selling. We're existing on a much higher plane. We're the backbone of the free world. We're the reason that life is worth living, that sort of thing. You see a lot of that in Coca-Cola shows.
Coca-Cola, here and now, wherever you may be. From the Empire State to the Golden Gate, from sea to shining sea.
This one is a real over-the-top, bombastic song that's sort of sketching out how Coca-Cola pretty much equals America and freedom and beauty and life worth living. And this is the sort of thing that would bring tears to the eyes of grown-up sales executives sitting in the audience.
In addition to writing songs that appear in such major films as Shane and Sabrina, Wilson Stone penned Coca-Cola's Here and Now, along with several other industrial show tunes for corporations like Chevrolet, Cadillac, and Xerox. Stone was drawn to writing industrial shows for the familiar reasons.
We would have a cast of 30 people and a 60-piece orchestra. You know, they were huge. And most of the we really used all Broadway people because they paid so much money. So we all did it just for the money.
The size and budget that industrial shows used to boast still amazes Hank Beebe, who worked in the field for over 20 years.
Well, the only figures I remember are the ones for the first show, which was in 56 for the 57 line. And that show was budgeted at six times the cost of bringing My Fair Lady to Broadway that same year.
Proud, proud, Chevrolet, proud. Proud, proud, Chevrolet, proud. Chevrolet, proud.
How does it feel?
By Beebe's math, that means that the 1957 Chevrolet Extravaganza carried a price tag of over $3 million. A considerable sum to be sure, but perhaps deserved.
It's an easy thing to write a song about love. It's hard to write a song about spark plugs.
How it feels to feel Chevrolet proud. Bright, broad banners everywhere.
Indeed, the lyrical content of many industrial show songs bordered on the bizarre. Again, Steve Young.
The Bathrooms Are Coming is from 1969 from the American Standard Company, and it's pretty much got everything you could want in an industrial show. It's got a song called My Bathroom, which is a sort of wonderful tribute to a woman's bathroom and how much it means to her.
My bathroom, my bathroom is a private kind of place, very special kind of place, the only place where I can stay, making faces at my face. My bathroom.
Like some traveling production of Cabaret for Carburetors, many of the industrial shows even toured from city to city for regional sales meetings. But by the mid-1980s, the light would dim on the industrial show. Bloated budgets and the emergence of multimedia presentations silenced the corporate chorus line. So today, the only place the industrial show lives on is in the living room of collector Steve Young, a fact that makes one wonder about the cumulative effects of listening to the over 150 industrial show albums that are in the possession of this sub-subgenre's sole archivist.
I wouldn't say I've been brainwashed by listening to these songs, but I feel like, boy,
I really like Massey Ferguson tractors now. I've never been on a tractor in my life, but boy, I'd be proud to own one. I'd be proud to sell and service one.
She's a driving rain and the wind on the plain. She's as hard as a Midwest winter. And there's no halfway when you're feeding the world. There's just no room for beginners. You hold the key to the land of the free, and you know the power is in her. So stand up proud and say it loud. This is the world of winners. Sing it!
Yes, we're Massey.
Massey's number one.
For On the Media in New York, I'm Rex Doane.
You're the man with the power in your hand.
So stand up proud and say it loud.
With Massey Ferguson.
Yeah!
There's media all around us. Media big and small.
There are media that are hard to kill, like in that movie by Seagal.
There's so much media everywhere, it's hard to find relief.
There's media in the food we eat and in the air we breathe.
I don't know what you're saying, but I know this much is true.
Our name is on the media, and we're the show for you.
On the media,
tune it in and turn it on.
On the media,
we've got the Punditron.
On the media,
we're your media watchdog.
On the media.
At onthemedia.org.
Media,
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 media
deserves a second look.
Media,
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 media.
That's why you've got Bob and Brooke.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced, cut and pasted by Janine Price and Katya Rogers. Engineered by Scott Strickland and George Wellington, and edited by Brooke. We had production help from Sean Landis.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. We'd like to welcome the newest member of the On the Media family, KJZZ in Arizona. We're the show for you. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Before I go, let me just fill my pipe.
Funding for On the Media is provided by the Ford Foundation, the Florence and John Schumann Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, the John T. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This program is a production of WNYC Radio New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.